will still pick things up.
Should have.
This is an interview with Mr. Herbert Dow Doan, who was the president of the Dow Chemical Company from 1962 through February of 1971. The interview was conducted in his office in Midland, Michigan on the 23rd of June, 1972. My name is Robert Weinert.
Well, first of all, I'd like to start out by asking you, the Dow Chemical Company is considered to be one of the giants in the chemical industry. And first of all, it is considered to be a success, obviously. I'd like to get your reaction or your definition. What's your definition of success?
Oh, success in the corporate sense, you mean?
Well,
you know. Not personal, but corporate.
Well, do you think there's a distinction between the two?
No, not really. It's good. You have a good point. I guess success has to be doing whatever you do well with high quality. Personally, maybe that's enough in terms of corporation. Success is measured by profit, but you don't make profit unless you are, unless the world's a better place because you're in business. That's a quote from Ben Branch, incidentally. So you try to do a good job for all of your publics, the employees, the stockholders, the customers, the country you live in, the world. If you do a really superior job of trying to help people in all of these kind of categories, you both make money and you do a high quality job. You make the money because you do a high quality job, and that's what you're trying to do.
What factors do you think contributed to success of Dow Chemical?
Oh, that's a
general,
awful broad question. It is a cliche, but also true, that the success of Dow is simply due to the people that have been associated with it. And these, from the beginning of Dow to the present time, have been an unusual collection of individuals, and they've done unusual things in unusual ways, and that's why it's been able to succeed. Incidentally, although Dow has always measured its progress by the profits it makes, it's nevertheless true that these unusual people always had, and doing an unusual job in their mind first and foremost. They really wanted to do what they're doing extremely well, and this resulted in the profits. Same kind of thing I was saying before.
Yeah. Well, in the book by Whitehead, The Dow Story, he quotes in there, or he says in there, and I quote, "The leadership in Dow has moved from grandfather to grandson as the years have passed, but the shadow of the grandfather is still there because it was he who shaped the basic thinking which gave the company its form and direction." Could you elaborate on what do you think Whitehead means by basic thinking? Was it the idea that you just said about the people that...
Yeah, I think if you develop a tradition of integrity and all the kind of statements that Herbert Dow used to make, like if you can't do a job better than other people, don't do it, or I can show you 100 men that'll show me why I can't do something, I want to find the one that'll show me why I can do something. These kind of thoughts and traditions get built into people as they grow up in the company, and there's a tendency to perpetuate what you've got. If, on the other hand, you run a rather shallow organization with shallow people, you tend to perpetuate this kind of thing. So I think there is a good deal of truth in the fact that that the past has a lot to do with the present and the future.
Mm-hmm. One theme which that I noticed that ran throughout his book was the availability of the executives, the top personnel in the company, to anyone that worked in the plant. It was said that in the early days, Herbert Dow spent more time in the plant than he actually did in his office. And Whitehead seems to stress this point, that the executives don't seem to isolate themselves from the everyday routine. I just wondered, does that sort of spirit still prevail because of the fact the company has grown so large?
Yes, it certainly does, and it is a very good illustration of the fact that the traditions of a company are important to its present and future, because you've asked a very good question. That may be one of the most fundamental things.
What I was just wondering is, has Dow been sort of boggled down by the fact that it's grown so much that...
No, there's no necessity. Obviously, big organizations have different problems than small organizations. But the fundamentals of your question, what you raised there, this business of availability of executives is a very important point, and it still exists and can exist very easily in a large organization, particularly if you have a traditional sort. This open door policy, as they call it, or availability of executives, means good communications with everybody in the company. And there's been a definite, deliberate attempt to keep this kind of philosophy going in the company. Ben Branch is a real proponent of this. He argues for a more strongly than anybody has for a flat organization. What you mean by a flat organization is there's very few people between the top and the bottom, and this means that people are in better contact, and it means that the executives have to be available to everybody, as against a very pyramided organization where you have to go through 15 people to get an answer to a question, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of the key strengths of Dow. This point you've raised.
Did you think that it's, in comparison to General Motors, which seems to be the sort of the epitome of a bureaucratic structure, do you think that GM has any sort of relationship with their top employees, with their, with the bottom people, as Dow does?
Well, I guess honestly, and certainly lacking some of objectivity, I don't think anybody does as good a job as Dow does of this for in the large companies. It's a real trick to run an organization in this way, and here again, the tradition of Dow helps this be done.
Yeah, well, has the growth of the the expansion of the company, has that in any way stifled individual initiative on the part of the employees?
I don't think so. I think this is a mute question. You can find in an organization of 47,000 people, there are going to be a lot of people who consider themselves to be stifled,
mm-hmm,
and
sure,
who get to worrying about this. But we find that the really capable people learn how the informal organization works within a company, and they learn how to handle this, and they aren't stifled. And I think this is very much, it's both the responsibility of the company to keep things loose and available, but in people terms, but it's also the responsibility of the individual to make sure he doesn't get stifled.
Mm-hmm.
And it can happen in a large company, perhaps not as easily, but it can happen if you work on it, that these individuals have a wonderful chance to develop.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a great strength of Dow.
Yeah. The book points out that, I hope I'm correct on this, that when you took over in 1962, you personally realized, you personally believed that the company had become too large for any sort of one-man control. And your plan of attack was to reorganize the organization and spread more of the decision-making out to the middle management people. Is this basically, am I correct in this?
Mm-hmm, yes.
How successful do you think you were in achieving this goal?
Well, I think quite successful. What you've said is certainly a bit of an oversimplification. We had developed some ways of operating that were obviously, by the history of the company, very successful in their time, but needed a few changes in order to correspond with a larger organization and the needs of the present, and we attempted to change it in that direction. I think this has worked out pretty well, but that's a very complicated subject, as a matter of fact, like all these are, of course.
Well, when you took over, you succeeded your father, right?
Yes.
How much of a difference in ideas or in what modern day your general business philosophy was there between you and your father, or was there? Did you see eye to eye pretty much on things? Or obviously, you saw a slight change there.
Yeah, well, I think it's...
was there a generation gap?
Everybody that comes along has new ideas. There's no truism like the fact that every new fellow that comes along likes to... It's the new broom business. Mm-hmm. Everybody likes to be a new broom and sweep clean and do some of his own thing. To me, this doesn't represent a generation gap. It's a sort of a logical progression. No, there was a lot of his philosophy I agreed with in the tradition of Dow. He ran a very informal organization. You know, Dow has never had an organization chart of the whole company in its history, and it still doesn't have one. He was a personable gentleman who ran the company in an informal way, and in that sense, there was no change at all. There was the need, in my view, to, as you suggested, change the organization, make some different working relationships within the company, but this wasn't really a difference in philosophy. It's just a need of the times, just as now Mr. Branch is doing things that need to be done today. Every time you change leadership, you're going to change the way things operate, which is one of the virtues of new leaders. You want to have things changing. Matter of fact, it's practically a goal of Dow never to let an organization gel, never to let it set up in cement, because then you've got the barriers that prevent communication, prevent people from talking to each other. So we try to keep the thing changing and fluid and all the time in order not to develop such a structure.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. Again, from the book, Whitehead pointed out that it, on certain occasions, it was sort of a monstrous problem to convert some of the discoveries that were made in the laboratories into a profitable large, to market them on a profitable large-scale basis. Is that still difficult, and could you sort of explain why it's difficult?
Oh, it's terribly difficult, because... the newer an invention is, the less ready the market is to accept it. People don't buy things just because you've made a great technical invention.
Yeah, some people say that much of American people actually don't need certain things that that American business produces, and the fact that the business produces it, they sort of force it on the people.
Mm.
Would you care to comment on that too?
Oh yeah, well that's a broader philosophical question. I think this does go on all the time. I happen to believe in the system that produces that. I think the system we've got does produce some useless products, one might say, sort of sold to the American public, and they like it, but they like it because they've been told to like it, kind of thing.
Has Dow ever done this?
Let me stick with that point just for a minute. The other side of that coin is that the system has produced really useful things in human terms, and done this 75 or 80% of the time, and the 20% of things we really don't need come along as a thing that the critics like to carp at, but the system does produce a preponderance of things that are really necessities, not frills. If you ask, has Dow ever produced something that isn't really needed? I guess I could. Well, I can't think of any right at the moment. We're in the consumer products business. We produce Touch of Sweden, which is a hand lotion. Is it or isn't it? we happen to think it's a great product, and it does technically a better job than any product that's ever been developed, but it does the human race disappear because we don't have Touch of Sweden? I couldn't say so. We are quite conscious of trying to... I think we've been in a fortunate position in this respect, that we produce things that are really basic to the economy. And incidentally, those basic products wind up in some pretty foolish things, I presume. Hula hoops must... hula hoops were made of plastic, you know. We're in a fortunate position in that we produce really useful products that solve a lot more problems than they create, so that we really haven't had this kind of a problem on our conscience. I think because we have produced such useful products that our attitude is to perpetuate this kind of thing and not to produce these sorts of things that are really dysfunctional in the economy.
Mm-hmm. This might call it sort of like an historical question, but during the Depression, during the 30s, the book pointed out again that while the majority of American business was fighting for survival, that during the 30s, Dow was able to actually grow and expand somewhat. Could you explain that?
Yeah, we were fundamentally the world was at the beginning of the chemical revolution, so there was a great deal of opportunity there. But that doesn't say everything that needs to be said. The people in Dow had the confidence. This was Willard Dow's mm-hmm. tenure in the company, and his great contribution was to have the nerve to say that. What we're doing is going to be extremely useful, and he really spent a lot of money on research while other people were retrenching. And as you suggest, this huge gamble paid off. It was a huge gamble. They were pouring money into the economy at the time when other people were so... The whole psychology of the country was so frightened that no sensible man was doing this. So it took a good deal of guts to pull this off.
Like, where were they able to get this money to do this?
They were making money, not very much in those days, and they were those were also the days when E.W. Bennett, as the financial man in the company, said. Debt is a good thing, and he was out borrowing money when other people were afraid to do this. So it was a combination of the guts to pour money into the research and the guts to go out and borrow money when other people were retrenching.
Sounds like you had some colorful figures.
Yeah.
At the outset of World War II, Dow was the only producer of magnesium in the country. And, of course, the magnesium was extensively used in the production of airplanes and other war material during World War II. This is sort of a question, is war good business? But how important was World War II as far as the material growth of Dow was concerned?
Well, the war was... the company growth is on the record. There was a good deal of growth during the war, obviously, because these materials like magnesium were needed. If you don't mind a comment, that's a paradoxical thing. Business can never do as well with a war as they can do without one. Mm-hmm. At the same time, one can't deny that the technology that gets pushed during a war just speeds up technological development quite a bit. We've long since passed that stage. We don't need wars anymore. We never did. The stock market goes down when there's a war scare on because it isn't looked on as a favorable development for business. This is a kind of thing that is difficult for people to understand because obviously when you have a war, there's a lot of material demands and things go up. If you don't mind a comment on this magnesium, we were the only producer at the start of the war. and the government accused us of dealing with the enemy, of holding up the development of the product. This is really nonsense. We've been trying to push magnesium since the 20s. We tried to push it to our own Air Force. They wouldn't have anything to do with it. The only time that the government got excited about magnesium was when they shot down a German airplane before the United States was even in the war and found out the Germans were using magnesium in airplanes, and then they wanted it. Well, we'd been trying to push it for 20 years prior to that with no success whatsoever.
Why do you think it was that no other chemical companies in the country foresaw the possible use of this?
Mm.
Or did they?
Well, not everybody can do it. No company can do everything, and this was just a little specialty metal that, if anybody took the trouble to look, knew Dow had been losing money for 20 years on it. It was a very tough technical problem, and nobody was willing to tackle it. It was, it's one of those foolish, persistent things that Dow has done that eventually paid off, but there was no attraction to anybody to get into the magnesium business. One producer, and he was losing his shirt, and it's so tough technically, it's there was just no attractiveness to it at all.
Right after the war, with Europe being in quote, shambles economically, why was Dow seemed to be rather reluctant to move into the international market? Why were they?
Well, this again is you're a product of your times. After the war, there were a lot of people like Sewell Avery who didn't really believe even in the United States. So people were worried about a depression right after the war. It took a good deal of nerve just to develop in the United States after the war because people really didn't know what the economy was going to do. Dow's energies were concentrated in developing the chemical industry in the United States, and we poured an awful lot of money in that period of time into the development of Texas. And because we did that, we were, of course, early in Texas, and we were the front runner in developing that whole Gulf Coast chemical complex. If at that time, it probably would have been a diversion that would have damaged us if we jump too quickly into this international thing. So each thing in its time. Our competitors look at us and say, how'd you ever get a hold of that international thing so early and do so well? Well, that's another story which has a lot to do with Mr. Branch, incidentally, but the timing of it, I think, turned out to be quite fortunate. But it, everything in its time. Those people were intent on developing the chemical business in the United States, and they did a terrific job of it. It's the same thing as the Midland was the source of cash that was allowed us to go pour money into. Then Texas and Midland were the source of money that eventually allowed us to go into foreign markets. But you can't look back and say why did all these things earlier. Matter of fact, Herbert Dow was quite an early internationalist. He had a bromine war with the Germans before he hardly started the plant.
Let's see. I don't know if it's been true in the past, but today there's a lot of talk about the responsibility that the business world has to the public, and I wondered how much responsibility do you feel a large company has to the community, to the public? I suppose you could say, how much responsibility do you have to the consumer?
Well, I think its ultimate responsibility is to the consumer. But you've got to let me talk about this because I think there is a great deal of confusion on this subject. People tend to say, why don't you take a little bit of your profit and spend it for social good? And this is really putting the cart before the horse and looking at profit in a totally illogical way as I see it. Mm-hmm. Our total responsibility is to society. We exist because society allows us to exist. We exist according to whatever rules they set up. Now, how do we do a job for society? It's our view in this area that there are an enormous number of things that a company can do within its competence to do an excellent job for what society wants and needs at the moment, and also make a profit. So, when it comes to environmental control, we approach that as a profit opportunity, and we know we're going to do a lot of good for what society wants in these days. We look at the promotion of women as an opportunity for... Better turn that thing off. We look at the promotion of women as a profit opportunity. This is obviously a huge human resource that we haven't treated right in the past, and if this is going to be good for women and good for Dow in a profit sense, the same thing goes for minority hiring. This is a good thing for the company as well as for society. So where we have the competence, we can very well swing into these needs and demands of society and make profit while we're at it. Now, the other thing I wanted to say is that it seems to me that we don't look at this thing correctly. The problem isn't profit and how much you make. As a matter of fact, one could make an excellent case that the most profitable company can do the best job for society. The problem is management. I think we have too many companies whose managements look at these social problems as something they is foreign to them. After all, that's our whole system is developed with companies trying to make money serving society. And what we should be complaining about, all of us, is management and whether or not it's doing a good job in the social area and making enough money to perpetuate the process as well. It will not do any good, as much as it sounds good in our heart, to take profit dollars and put them into social projects, because this just doesn't last very long or do very well. As a matter of fact, in most cases, people get outside of their competence and just make a mess of the thing they're trying to do good with anyway. So that the real attack here, to my mind, should be against the manager who isn't managing his resources for the good of society and the good of his company, both.
Yeah, well, some people might take the position that the business is there to make a profit, and that's all. They have no responsibility to society whatsoever. How would you answer that?
Well, I have never met a manager who believed that profit and the good of society were separable. It's this is a thing that comes from the critics who don't understand this themselves, who say to industry, you're interested in profits, you're not interested in society. Mm-hmm. It's the very fundamental of industry is simply to do something for society. Now, incidentally, the profit mechanism obviously doesn't say in itself that all these things are going to be to the ultimate good of society. So you need rules and laws and government regulations to control the normal avarice of a guy who's out trying to make a buck. Mm-hmm. You got to have environmental controls and rules. We need the FDA. We need the antitrust laws. Of course, we in industry hope these laws don't proliferate to the point where you can't even operate, but the way to channel industrial effort into socially useful ways is to pass judicious laws, taxes, incentives, one way or another, to aim them in the right directions. We aim them in the right direction by passing environmental laws.